Being trained in an effective crisis management system is imperative for minimizing behavioral issues and the need for restraint in schools and treatment facilities. But not all crisis management systems were created equal. If we are going to meet the growing intense behavioral needs of individuals while simultaneously reducing the need for restraints, every leader and policymaker who is involved in areas related to behavioral challenges should understand what a complete crisis management system is comprised of and how to embed one into any setting. For more information, check out crisisintervention.com.
Welcome to the Crisis in Education Podcast, where educational leaders and experts across the world dissect the root causes of issues and explore potential opportunities for sustainable improvement across schools and districts. And now your co-hosts, Dr. Pauly and Drew.
Okay, welcome to the Crisis in Education Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Pauly, and I'm here with my good friend, psychologist, Mike Bonavento. Mike, how you doing, my brother?
I'm doing good, Paul. It's great to see you.
Yeah, man. So Mike and I go way, way back to 2006 when I first began working in a school district as a behavior analyst. And Mike and I, man, we were on the front line. We saw some tough things. In fact, I was just speaking to Mike offline before we came in. There was a particular year that was maybe the most challenging in my career, but ended up being the fuel for almost everything I've done since that time. Do you remember that year, Mike?
Oh, certainly. It was an elementary school where we worked. It was a school that had a lot of children at the school that were in poverty. Many of them had, you know, what we would now call adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. It was kind of known as a challenging school, both academically, but more than anything, behaviorally. People were sort of like, this is a tough school.
Yeah, it was. And were you there the year before?
No, actually, okay. I think we wound up there. Like, I think that was part of the kind of quote unquote grand plan at that year.
It was
kind
turnaround.
Okay, you're kind of a behavior guy, Paul, certainly. And they're like, well, that's your interest, Mike. So let's get you there too. And I was like, oh, okay, sounds good.
Well, I actually talk about this in my keynotes. I call it the perfect storm. And that is, you probably know these details, but if not, maybe I'll fill in some hole here.
Oh, that'd be great.
My wife and I had just moved up to the county the year before, and she was actually working there. And maybe mid-year, I had gotten assigned to work with one of the special ed classes. The teacher was lovely in there. In fact, well, when I remember showing up to school and getting, you know, where you park, and there was the bus.
Yeah,
it wasn't
yeah.
a bus loop, but it was out back, right,
yep,
at the breezeway. Yep. And it was in the morning, like there were no staff out there, but there were kids running around everywhere. I'm like, what?
Yes.
What the heck is going on? It was crazy. And I walked through and, man, the kids were getting overly aroused and all sorts of craziness. And I went to the classroom and that classroom was doing fine. They were actually using direct instruction. Remember SRAs?
Yes.
You know, and
yes.
The kids were very engaged. And there was one kid that had some stuff, but it wasn't bad at all. But I remember leaving again at the end of the day and same thing. The bell rang and kids would run out. Well,
absolutely.
Well, that year, Mike, they ended up having 792 events of suspension. So that's not days, that's events.
Yeah.
They were
so
getting upwards
that.
of 50 calls a day for a student removed from the classroom, right?
Yeah.
This is why the next year I ended up we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Right.
And so a deputy superintendent or assistant superintendent came to me and said, you know, hey, do you think you can help turn the school around? And I thought to myself, hell no, what am I going to do with this? It's a mess, you know? I didn't believe in myself, but I did believe in the science. And so I said, okay. And I ended up going to a friend of ours, a colleague, Peggy Sewell. And said, you know, I kind of feel like, because Mike, the whole school had been trained in PBS. Right. USF had come out and they had a grand plan and there was training. They did all the stuff at the stations at the beginning of the year. And I'm like, well, I didn't see any evidence of that, you know, that training. And I said, I kind of think we need PBS for the adults. And she said, well, there is something like that. It's called organizational behavior management. And that's what, you know, that's what somebody handed me the book, Bring Out the Best in People, which I'm actually, that's part of the curriculum for the course I teach now, which is awesome. And I just had Aubrey's brother write a foreword for my new book. Isn't that crazy how things come full circle?
That was very cool.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you did that. You know,
that's yeah. Well, so the next year, and I'm going to fill in the holes in just a second. That school went from 792 suspensions to 67. That was the year that you and I were there, and another team of people that come out. But that
previous
year, and we'll talk about some of the things that we had to do there and some of the errors that were made coming in.
Sure.
That previous year, it was, if you remember, it was brand new administration.
Oh, yeah.
It was a brand new student body because they had elected to stop busing because since 1972, the district had been under a court order to desegregate. And that's
Yes,
why they started busing, right? So they ended that in like 2001 or two. Now, and so they, and I understand because, like, you know, it costs a lot of money and the parents didn't want to bus. The kids don't want to be on the bus, you know? So you think, let's make a community school. We're going to make it about the community. But the problem is that, as you and I both know, diversifying the socioeconomic makeup of the schools can have a huge impact on student achievement because the kids tend to learn great from the peer behaviors around them, right?
Absolutely.
And they had new teachers. They had also hired a bunch of new teachers. Well, that year, the school had gone from an A to an F, and that's where we had come in. So I'm kind of setting up the story for this. And, you know, and so if we look at that, if we look at the year before, I know you weren't there the year before, but you've seen a number of schools fail with PBIS. At the time, it was just PBS and maybe our school-wide PBS.
Yep.
You know, what were some of the challenges there? Like, why do you think, what were some of the main variables that you would use to account for the failure of people to embed and implement the system effectively?
And I think what I always go back to is there's, you know, and I think you're certainly well aware of this. There's a couple of variables that I think are very key in accounting for differences in implementation. So the two that I always remember as being very key were sort of the idea of administrative support and also team functioning. So, and when we talk about administrative support, what I always think is it's not just support, it's modeling, it's coaching, as you mentioned earlier, it's not just being a cheerleader for something like saying, oh, let's do this, isn't it nice? It's more like we do this to make the environment supportive for our students, and it's our job to do this. So I definitely saw some issues with that, and then sometimes the teams would be composed not just of some team, you know, school leaders and people that had real influence at the school, but sometimes you would get people that were put on the team not for good reasons, like this person has real trouble with or challenges with behavior management, so I want them to go on the team and learn, which is an admirable goal, right? I mean, you can't fault the intention with that. But what would happen sometimes is they would just kind of get on there and they'd be like, well, I don't believe in any of this. Why are we doing this? It's like, well, you know, we can teach you and we can offer this as a, you know, an alternative, but sometimes people had real philosophical differences about just the basics of this, you know, that we try to reward or recognize appropriate behavior at a much higher, in a much higher proportion than we do to providing correctives. You know, our correctives are very strategic and clear. So those are two things I definitely saw, you know.
All right. So let's stay on that for just a second.
Sure.
Because now we were both trained, I think, a few times by USF.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes. I remember we had some good times going out there and getting trained. It was cool. And then again, they did a train the trainer, a pyramidal training model where they came out and you know, they trained us, and then we trained people in the district, and I think they were present, right, to give feedback. And isn't that the way it went?
Absolutely. And I think, and I don't want to go too far off our track here, but I think a key component for probably about 10 to 12 years was we had regular retrainings for schools. So schools could say, you know what, we've had a lot of turnover, we want to change our plan, we want to do some different things. And our, you know, at that point, the district offered some support and stipends for people to come back in and just reacquaint themselves with the basics. So it's kind of, it was almost like training camp, if you want to use like the football analogy.
Okay. All right. So I'm actually making notes on this stuff because I have so much to say about all this because I think that, all right, hold on. I think that again, back in those days, there was, people may or may not know this, but there was an issue with PBIS in the field of ABA. And yeah. That is that I think they tried to say like their own science or something. I don't know quite the details of it. Something along those lines, right? I'm like, this is just ABA, right? It's ABA, and it's a package grounded in the science of human behavior.
And what else is it?
Yeah, right. And so some people took a lot of offense to it, but they also took offense to the fact that, and I remember this. This was one of a good friend of mine and yours, Frank. Frank and I used to go back and forth about PBS. He did not like it at all.
Right.
And I understand why, because one of the things he would say, they don't believe in punishment. I'm like, well, that's not true. If you look at early research, and I saw it myself because I did my dissertation in a PBS related metric. Yeah. I'll talk about that in a little bit if I remember. But they did talk about it. But like you mentioned, it really was about the ratio. It's about creating an environment where we taught behavior and, that we focus mostly on reinforcing it, and but we do have to correct. But I felt that in not only in the training that we did received from USF, but also as a result of that, the training that we provide to people, we didn't talk about correction much. We did not give people the tools they needed to correct effectively, and so it left people thinking that PBS didn't work. Yes. And because they were being kind of side, you know, they were being disarmed, so to speak. Understandably why, because we were afraid, I think I remember hearing people justify this to give people talk about punishment because they're going to go to it because it's so immediately reinforcing, right? We do this thing.
It can be,
see,
right?
Yeah. It impacts behavior and that reinforces our behavior of using punishment. But the problem is that we can also screw things up with too much, you know, just because something says positive reinforcement. Positive doesn't necessarily mean good or bad. It's just something added. We could be positively reinforcing the wrong behaviors, you know.
Oh, sure,
and
certainly.
Yeah. And so people associated PBIS, and I talked with Dave about this on our podcast a few months ago, right, with token economies. And I think token economies, personally, yeah, you and I talked about this, I think, a while back. Yeah. I think you feel differently about it. I think token economies is one of the reasons that PBIS failed because people didn't understand the application of it and the real purpose of PBIS. So we can't blame the people, right?
No.
Because that's a product
right?
of the training that we gave them. That's a product of the training that we receive, right? Because if we start blaming, we're no longer looking at ABA. But I remember in these meetings, people talking about like the school store and this and that. And I'm like, I just want you guys to smile at the kids. Can we just be nice to them? Can we thank them? Yeah. Ask them how their weekend was doing, you know? And then maybe we layer on some tokens to make it fun intermittently. So, you know, that was a lot to unpack there, you know, but
yeah.
I think, you know, the training and how people viewed PBIS and the training we were giving them, I think that was part of the issue. If we start from the top, right, we're not training them well enough.
Let's take a quick break.
If you work across schools or treatment facilities and you want an environment characterized by students or clients behaving well and meeting their goals, you need everyday behavior tools. These tools are so powerful and generalizable that you can train anybody, anywhere in them. And here is the best part. The entire instructor training is online. If you are interested in becoming an everyday behavior tools trainer to improve behavior in your organization while also generating more income for yourself, go to crisisintervention.com.
No, I would agree with that. And you know, Paul, I think as I went along with this, I think I started with the idea that, you know, having like a robust reward system, I think, can be very powerful. I think in addition to it is a time consuming and resource consuming thing. There's no question of that. You have to really monitor it. And, you know, and people sort of have different feelings about tangible versus intangible and all those things. But I think what I came to sort of teach people eventually, and certainly now is the way I think about it, is the tangible part or the token piece is something you can use. It is a device that can be helpful in terms of having a tangible measure of how often something is happening, like who's participating, right? It's concrete for little kids occasionally, you know, some that works sometimes. But I really shifted from, I think, look, you got to do this, to look, if you can do it, it's great, but focus. There are many different ways to recognize or affirm a behavior. And when you said it earlier, just smile, look, you know, kind of stop a kid someplace in the hallway and say, hey, look, I love how respectful you're being right now. You know, somebody walked right in front of you and you just kind of held back for a second. Good job. Mm-hmm. That's respectful. So it's like pairing that, those on the spot things with real behavior specific praise. And there's no substitute for this sort of positive affect. Like, I'm so glad you're here today. And that's
sincerity,
really
like, man, be sincere.
Yeah, no, you know that. Right? It's like, not just, here's your thing, keep doing the thing you just did, thank you.
Well, it became about that because, again, we can't blame the people. They didn't understand the purpose of it. And so one of the tools that I use when I go into these, when I work with educators, is like, I help them do perspective taking. And I say, imagine if you worked in a school, and too often this happens though, and the school leader was doing this, that, and the other to you, how would you feel? Would that bring out the best in you? You know, would you, you know, would you accelerate your performance? Or when you saw that person, would you not want to be around? Now imagine not being able to leave and being stuck with that person every day, all year long, you know? And so, you know, this is the essence of it. The essence of it is developing good relationships. It's teaching, but one of the things that people didn't understand, and I didn't even understand it back then, and I was a behavior analyst, I would hear, well, we got to reteach. And like, I'm like, okay, like, let's talk about this, right? I've come full circle on it. If we look at what teaching is, what really is, what I hear and what everybody else, I think 99.9% of people hear, is that we're retelling the same thing, right? And because they already know, if I say,
yeah,
what he's supposed to do, what's honest, the expectation, right? What's going to happen? Well, they know. Right? I'm supposed to do this, supposed to do that. Well, why are we reteaching? The real teaching happens from the reinforcement and the punishment, right? No, the correction. I know people don't like the word punishment. Punishment is just a stimulus that decreases the future occurrence of a behavior. And it's just fine to do if you're in an environment that's rich with positive reinforcement for value-added behavior. It's fine. It's correcting behavior. We do it for somebody's doing math and we say, you know, hey, don't do it that way because, you know, it's going to lead to this thing. It's going to make you, you know, you're going to get to the end of it. It's going to be a lot of work for you. Do this instead, right? So we stopped one behavior and we started another behavior that gets them in touch with reinforcement.
Well, honestly, Paul, you know, and you hit on something I think that's really crucial. And this is something I did not understand at the time. I wish I had, because it would have changed the way I talked about stuff or really coached or instructed folks. But the notion is of finding or the replacement or other behavior you want, you know, like I always thought of like the school rules as being replacement behaviors based on behaviors that we saw at our school that, you know, the data that we had that we didn't like or we thought were inappropriate, right? So for it to be a really good, I think, effective replacement behavior, it has to be more efficient in accessing that function than it is, than the problem behavior is, right? So when you talk about like just reteaching, it's kind of like, you know, all right, I said this at you once, I'm going to say it at you again, right? It's just, it's like stuff kind of flying at you and you're like, well, yeah, but it's easier for me just to scream.
Well,
so
this is exactly what we've done though with the educators themselves.
Yeah.
That is, that stuff, all that stuff is retelling. That's an antecedent, right?
Yes.
Just the same way trainings are antecedents and goal settings and the plans that we wrote and all those things are antecedents.
Yes.
We needed to get people in touch with consequences for their behavior, right?
Absolutely.
We needed to help teachers see that this, there's some value for them in it. It makes their job easier. Kids are behaving better. They're learning more. Whatever it is that's in touch with what's important to them.
Yes.
And I don't think that, you know, when PBIS, part of what they did, and I understand the rationale for some of this stuff, so it's easy in hindsight. There's no knock on them. They did something amazing with it, you know?
Yeah.
I think, what was it? Like, there had to be criteria, like 80% or 90% of the school was on board for
Yes,
that before
80.
they'd bring in, right?
Yeah, at
And
least 80.
so, you know, that's okay. That's like a sales pitch, right? If you understood it, you get on board. So if somebody is like a
Exactly.
shitty speaker, you know what I mean? There goes a great system. You know what I mean? That's not, they're not going to do
Yeah.
it. But then there's also the unsaid rule here, and that is we're going to be a PBS district, you know? And so the school leader, you know, they read between the lines. We need to be a PBS school, but they're not buying into it, right? And the buy-in needs to come from the people above to help them see. It should be reinforcing them, help them to see that their job's going to get easier, that the teacher's going to perform better, the students are going to be behaving better, that they're going to produce results. And so helping people understand that this is going to get them in touch with valued outcomes, right, that are reinforcers, or helping them avoid things that are pain points, becomes extremely powerful. But I don't think people understood the purpose of that.
No, I think there was a missed opportunity with that for sure. And this is just kind of a maybe a little corollary to this. I remember working with a particular middle school teacher. He was love this guy. He was hilarious. He was just a personable, nice guy, but he genuinely had very significant and real philosophical differences with the idea of providing reinforcement or reward for behavior. He was really in that old school mode of like, look, they should just do it. You know, they should know how to do it. It's like, can't argue with you. However, and what really, and I'm not saying we ever really kind of came to a meeting of minds, but what I did with him a little was a little bit different. And I talked to him about, now he happened to be a New England Patriots fan. So you walk into his room, there's a big picture of Bill Belichick on his wall, right? Great coach, right? So I'm a Steeler fan, so I'm like, it hurts to say that, but I say it. So
He is a great coach.
yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to argue with the results, right?
Right.
So we were having the conversation about, and I saw this big picture of Belichick on his wall, and I said, so I just want to ask you a question. I respect your differences on this. You know, again, you like truly I do. You know, it's like you don't have to believe as I believe, but I talked to him about the idea that a big piece of this is really, as you talk about, executing the behaviors, really knowing what to do and how to do it and doing it at the right time. So it's kind of like running a play in a loose sense, right? So this is the plan is kind of like the playbook. And I asked him, I said, so you're a Belichick fan? He's like, yeah, of course I am. Steelers suck. You know, I threw that in at the end. I'm like, yeah, I know. So he goes, so I asked him, so how often do you think Coach Belichick has to say to people, look, you know, you have to believe in my plan. You have to believe in my philosophy. You must in order for this to work. Or does he say, do your job, execute at a high level. This is how you do it. So part of the conversation was, look, I'm not trying to change your philosophy. I'm trying to get you to, you know, quote unquote, and I didn't say it in this technical way, but it's like emit the appropriate behavior at the appropriate time. Do this at a high level. That is something that is certainly within your power to do. You know, you're like, I don't believe, you know, it's like somewhat to me, it's like tantamount to saying, I don't believe in long passes, so I just won't run those routes, even though that's what the defense is giving me right now. Right.
Yeah.
I just don't believe in that philosophy. And then Coach Belichick said, oh, okay, I understand. Don't do it. It's not going to happen, right?
Well, I think, you know, you hit on a good point there. A very common thing with the tokens, or a complete misunderstanding of what reinforcement is. Two things. Like, I remember one time I was given a training on crisis management, and somebody said, you know, you're telling me that everybody does something to get something and get away from something. Like, you're the and he like cited like 9/11, you know, and people running in the building. You think they did that to get pats on the back and do this? And I'm like, man, I'm not saying that. Clearly, I'm not speaking on this right. I'm like, I think that was a value of theirs, you know what I mean? And so
Absolutely.
they were behaving for that, you know, and, you know, that all is also, it's a naturally occurring reinforcer, it's a sense of satisfaction and that you get, you know. So I don't want, but people need to understand that you know, whatever positive reinforcement we're giving, right? It's only, first of all, a positive reinforcement if it strengthens or increases the behavior, right? You might think it is. You're attempting to reward something, right, with the purpose of changing behavior or, you know, keeping it going in the future. But if it doesn't impact behavior, then it's not a positive reinforcement. It might be well-intended reward, but it's not functioning as a positive reinforcer. Yeah,
absolutely.
So people need to understand that stuff, when it comes to learning, it's intended to guide learners to eventually finding value and joy in the process itself, right? That's ideal. Like the most powerful positive reinforcer that a teacher could engage in the classroom would be engaging instruction that's, you know, a little bit challenging to the students, right? So there's a want, they feel good about doing it, right? That's the first line of defense. If the student doesn't find meaning in the work, you know, then we have to find something that creates that meaning for them. I wish they all wanted to learn math, and they might be learning it or engaging in the work just to avoid getting a bad grade or getting in trouble. That's not going to get the best out of anybody. They're going to do just enough to get by, you know, and that's it. Or they're going to, and maybe end up hating math. So that is the purpose of this stuff. And I think putting it back in like the, in his lap, saying that, you know, well, you know, in the Belichick example, I do think that Belichick made a great speech with his philosophy, right? Because I think that's good leading, you know, getting people fired up about it. But then it's about executing the play, right? And showing them that by executing the play, something good happens, right? They score a touchdown or whatever.
Exactly.
And it's like, I'm not telling you to change the student's behavior. I just want you to try these things, right? And do it a small. That's why I wrote quick wins, right? Just do the small little area. We did it. That came out of that school, by the way. It was changing that breezeway initially. Do you remember that?
Oh absolutely. Yeah. Honestly, Paul, that's one of the things that I think is a really key component that they don't really address in the training as a whole, is that notion of finding something that's going to have an immediate positive impact that's very observable for people. Not just, well, you know, we had 300 kids participate in our event, and that's great. But I also think the piece of like, you know what, when I walk into school in the morning, it's not like the Indianapolis 500 in that breezeway, and I'm not stopping people every 5 seconds. And right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of the atmosphere or the school culture in a way. Like, our place is safe. And I would even argue, I would imagine you would agree with this to some degree. The idea that when you have kind of a stable, predictable environment, what you're doing is you're being, I would argue, sort of trauma informed in a way that, you know, isn't always talked about. It's like, our environment is safe, it's predictable, it's kind. And for kids who have those issues, and even for the kids who don't, we know that makes school a welcoming place. And that's really, I think, what most of us want.
I want to dig into trauma informed with you before we get off the podcast, or I have some thoughts about that. But yes, absolutely. And predictability. And I think this was one of the big mistakes that they made, was going too broad. They started from the outside in, and I kind of think that we need to go from the inside out, meaning start at the classroom level, right? And get teachers to build their own systems in their classroom, right? What are their, by the way, the term expectations, I think it was a bad term for school-wide expectations. I think Champs had it right. They would say stuff like guidelines for success, right? I would just call these values, right?
I think that's a congruent term, right?
Yeah. What are our school values, right? And I think expectations should be reserved for the very precise behaviors, the pinpoint behaviors that we want students to engage in the classroom. And it's not just, it goes beyond rules. Rules are important, and they're a general guideline for behaviors across schools. Show up on time, be prepared, you know what I mean? You know, keep your hands and feet to yourself, whatever it is. Expectations become different for different teachers because they have a different set of expectations, like getting up, as you know, and can you go to the bathroom? When can you go to the bathroom? You know, can you, you know, if it's a small group activity, can you talk? How long can you talk? Who can you talk to? Et cetera, all those kind of things. And I think if we would help teachers just improve a small part of their day, one transition, You know what I mean? One transition, it got better as a result of the stuff. Then we generalize it. We that should be the way I think we plug into a school. That's really creating a want, not people just saying, yes, I'm going to do it and raising their hand because there are other people raising their hand. They're saying, this has value for me. Yes. So let's do it everywhere.
Well, you know, Paul, and this is like maybe a very abstract way to think about it, but I'm always very interested in like dynamic systems, right? It's kind of that science of, you know, looking at really complex systems. In a classroom, in a school, is just a complex system in a lot mm-hmm. of ways. So what do we know about making small changes? They tend to cascade up in the system, right? Mm-hmm. If you do them correctly and you have, you know, you kind of pick your spot reasonably well. So I think it makes more, at least from, you know, maybe I have an imperfect understanding of this. I wouldn't be the, you know, would be the first time, right? But the idea is you create something at the lowest level, and then it kind of impacts stuff at higher levels. And then all of a sudden, the kind of the emergent picture is, wow, our classes are orderly now. Mm-hmm. Everyone's happier because things are smoother within the classroom. Our routines are really solid.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not having to correct this every 5 minutes.
That is a deal, brother. I look at it as a form of behavioral momentum. I see quick wins as like an organizational yes, behavioral
absolutely.
Momentum. So it's getting people to do things that are easy to do, don't require a lot of effort, and produce a valued outcome. I actually just added that to the new book I'm working on, Positional Authority and Leadership. And it's kind of like like when you're planning this stuff, you have to look at it like as a cost-benefit analysis. And that is the cost, though, in terms of effort. Like if you're asking people to do things that are very effortful and it's not producing some sort of immediate reinforcement that's enough magnitude, they're going to stop doing it. They're going to do some other things, or they're going to do just enough to get by and only when you're looking. And so you need to plan for consequences. You need to think about how hard is it to do and what's going to be the added value for people. And, you know, like that teacher said, well, the student should just be doing it. Well, imagine your school leader saying, well, you just need to be doing this stuff. People might start to do it, but they're going to do just enough to get by and only when you're looking, right? They need to understand how it's going to add value to them, right? Oh. How it's going to be. And if they value student learning, great. And that's one of them. Of course, I believe that most of them do. But certainly they value orderly, predictable classrooms that have a minimal of behavioral challenges. That nobody wants to deal with that stuff, man. So we have a lot of people who, if they knew better, they would do better. But knowing isn't telling. They got to have the skills to do it.
Yeah.
They got to believe that, and this is self-efficacy. They got to have response efficacy. If I do, it's going to produce the outcome, and they got to value the outcome, right? And we got to get people in touch with positive reinforcement. That's what this comes down to in the end for their behavior.
I agree, Paul. And I think, you know, it even goes to just this idea of, you know, we were talking about this just a little earlier, but I think ultimately a lot of the practices that are aligned with positive behavior interventions and support, if they're done well, and, you know, and well meaning like they're well thought out, well taught, well coached, all of that, they ultimately turn out to be pretty efficient, you know, and I think that's a key part of this. So, you know, you said it like just a minute ago, like if you have to put this much effort into it, man, I gotta see something out of that. Otherwise, like you said, you shift to something else that's a little less effortful and gives you kind of the result, and you're like, that's good enough. I'm not losing sleep anymore.
I'm not getting in trouble. A lot of people are doing this.
Exactly.
I'm not getting in trouble anymore.
Exactly. I'm not getting hollered at. I'm not, you know, my principal isn't showing up at the room saying like, this is the fourth time I've been here today. You know? Yeah. So
dude, I think that, you know, the other piece of this, because that quick win becomes a metric, right? It's it's an indice of progress.
Certainly.
It's helping people if you know what they value. This is why we need to, when Anika and I go in, Anika Costa, my colleague and I, and we help schools develop systems, we start with values, right? We unpack them. We use the ACT matrix, and we unpack them. We find out what people are, what's important to them. Values are just a way of being, doing. So we're going to come back to behavior. That's why I want to talk about trauma-informed care in a little bit. And then, you know, we find out what people might be doing in response to certain things, and is that aligned with their values and what should be going on, right? What's the replacement behavior? And that's going to lead them towards those values, and unpacking that stuff is powerful, man. But the system, those values should flow through the entire system. And excuse me, too often they're just writing on the wall, man. They're just writing on the wall, and it doesn't work.
No, I agree with that. And I think that was something that, even though I think when we trained, we talked about this a lot, but we didn't really, I think, take the
Understand it.
additional step of really showing people how to do it in the best way. But the idea that whatever your expectations or values are, all members of the organization display those. It's not just, well, this is what we expect the kids to do. Well, we can do whatever we want. We're adults. No. The modeling piece of this is very, very powerful in my mind. If you're a
Dude.
parent, right? What are your kids doing? They're not like going, I'm listening to every word you're saying. Sure, they are at some level, but the other part is they're like, I want to see what he does.
Bro, this is actually, I didn't, this is completely unplanned, but this is actually a really good spot to transition into trauma-informed care, right? And so I know you mentioned, because both of us had been trained in ACEs many years ago, adverse childhood experiences. And I know that we both worked in very high poverty schools. And certainly these guys had a lot of bad experiences, right? That would fall
Most certainly.
under the criteria for ACEs. Here's one of I've been caught up in some discussions about trauma-informed care over the past year and a half, 2 years, but I put my money where my mouth is with it. And here was some of the things, because I, first of all, let me start here. I love the principles of trauma-informed care, right? I
Absolutely.
preach them. You just reviewed my book, Mike. You can see that they are echoed. Safety, right? Helping people feel safe, trustworthy and transparency, peer support, collaboration, empowering people, right? Respect. I call this the way shit should be, Mike. Okay. I don't think it needs to fall under trauma-informed care. This is the kind of environment that I think we should have for everybody. What should not be in there is an environment for everybody, right? So I got to start with that premise. Okay. What I hear a lot is that I hear the word trauma coming out of people's mouths a lot in response to a child's behavior. Okay. And been traumatized, and I think sometimes it, but by saying it means like back off. You know what I mean? Don't push them to do something. Okay. And
Well said.
I get that 100%. Okay. My issue would come down to if somebody wasn't by definition truly traumatized. Okay. Because as a student of behavior analysis, that if a kid throws a tantrum, because he doesn't want to do math and it works for him, he'll be able to escape doing math in the future, right? So we have to be very considerate about that, right? We have to think about what is the real function of the behavior. So when I was hearing all this stuff, and because I do align so much with the principles, and this goes along perfectly with what you just said about you just can't talk about the values, they got to be embedded. I ended up looking at it through an organizational behavior management lens, right? So I'll explain what I did. It's actually, I'll drop the link to the video. I created a video on it. When I said I put my money where my mouth is, I created a video for it. I created like an outline on how to unpack a trauma-informed care, because I see schools and organizations saying that we are a trauma-informed school. We are a trauma-informed, okay, but hold on. No, you're not. No, you're not. And here's how I know, because not even the trauma-informed care people are talking about this, right? The developers of this. If you're going to be number one, have you a trauma-informed care, what result are you using to measure that, right? How are you measuring impact, right? How would you
Sorry, I don't mean to
know
laugh,
whether,
but that's
okay, so we
right
need to
on.
start there, okay? Now we go ahead and we strategically plan with the end in mind, talk about this in the quick wins, and that is okay. So we need to know what the wants and the needs of that student is, okay? For that student. So we've identified, let's say we do have some more sort of metric that lets them know that they were trauma, they met some ACE criteria, but still, that's still not a measure of, that might be an assessment that they have it, but what's a measure of things getting better for them, right? Is it social validity, right? I feel safe. I feel trusted, right? I think that would be fine, right? We have those values, the principles, have that as one of the measures that you can use, Okay. But how do we help that child feel safe, trusted, and trustworthy, supported by peers, collaborative, blah, blah, if that teacher doesn't feel that way? Okay. Which means we need to know the wants and the needs of the teacher, right? And that teacher needs to know what behaviors to engage in that are going to impact the student to meet their wants and their needs. Okay, if we want that for teacher, now we need to go up the chain. We have to chain that performance. Okay, what's the administration need to do to help them feel safe and trusted and peer supported and all those kind of things, right? And it's going to come down to their behavior. And all those things need to be driven by the values. One of the values is trauma-informed care, right? Those principles or whatever. But if you don't break it down to the interlocking behaviors, right, that are aligned with this result that's measurable, you do not have a trauma-informed environment. And this can all be unpacked. And that's what I did here. So I think the problem with it coming off of everybody's tongues too much is that the kids who really need to be treated with kid gloves, for lack of a better term, right, are not getting what they need, because if everybody's traumatized, then nobody's traumatized, okay? And we got to make sure that they really get what they need, because they've had exceptional, you know, and those environments that we worked in, Mike, those ones where lots of these guys were probably by definition, you know, traumatized, to impact their behavior, we had to impact the behavior of the 40 teachers in those schools, right? We can look at the PBS. It wasn't about PBS is about adult behavior, student behavior.
It is most certainly. And you know, Paul, I really like the point you made about, the idea that trauma-informed care is, in order to make the environment predictable, I think, and sort of supportive, rules and sort of guidelines and limits are an essential piece of this. I think if you talk to anyone who treats kids with trauma and they talk to parents, one of the first things they talk about is, yes, you're going to be very compassionate and understanding about what this child has gone through, but your environment is going to be predictable and sure, because rules and things like that equal safety. Kids feel like someone's in charge, because so often they feel out of control. So the way that you help them to learn that is, okay, when I come here, I'm safe. Everybody, the grown-ups are in charge. They're helping. There, look around me. There's helpers as far as the eye can see. So I think you're exactly right. And to do that, you can't be someone who's constantly in fear of losing your job or getting screamed at as a teacher, right? By a higher up.
Well, I think they also feel that if somebody's been in trauma-informed, that it means that they can no longer correct behavior. And that if they correct behavior and the child throws, you know, responds emotionally, that, you know, somehow they're being re-traumatized. And certainly, whatever that means, but certainly that if it can be the case with somebody is been truly traumatized, right? I wish that we could, you know, ideally we would have some sort of biometric, you know, that showed that a stimulus in the presence of this stimulus, and it's generalizable, you know, the stimulus in different areas, well, the stimulus is there, that you get this kind of response, heart rate increases, blood rate increases, whatever it is, you know, I mean, that go along with, because maybe there's some people who you're not seeing the over behavior at all, right? They're just kind of getting wide-eyed, right? And all this other stuff's going on in there. It would be nice to have that kind of metric. And maybe, you know, we could do that right now with like smartwatches and everything, you know, to look for patterns of this, to really now start to figure out and pinpoint the stimulus that's evoking this. Yeah. Yeah. We could get down to the nitty gritty on this stuff, but
Oh no, I'm sorry. I think you're very much onto something there. I really believe, you know, and because I see things sort of through a behavioral lens, I think in a sense, if you do not provide correction or sort of corrective feedback to a kid when they're in the, you know, having these kind of persistent difficulties, I mean, it's hard for me to say that you're doing them any kind of a favor. You know, like, it's kind of like, oh, well, we didn't upset you. Well, I mean, name a person in life who doesn't get upset sometimes. You know, I don't know. I don't know that anyone is really going to ever be exempt from that. And you don't want to be cruel, right? We know that. That's a kind of bottom line thing. But it's like, if we don't correct this, not only will it continue, but it may morph into some other things that are considerably worse for kids. So I think we have a responsibility to do that.
Well, I think you're nailing it, man. I think that it's this subject is very sensitive for people.
Certainly.
And I think that people are afraid to speak about it in this way because it makes it seem like somehow we're anti that. As I said, I live those values. There's not anything that I've written that go against those principles in there, right? It's everything they talk about. Like my whole that whole book is about, like, stop being this person, right? Create an environment where people feel safe and cared for and supported and all these different things. But I think that and I know there are people who also say that, well, we need to create this kind of environment for learning. And I also agree with that, right? Yeah. For most cases, we're talking about learning academics, but there's something that hasn't been that we don't talk about, and that is learning resilience, right?
Yes,
and resilience
absolutely.
Is should be shaped. And I think, and I suspect that this is just, I haven't read this anywhere. I just kind of think this probably from my own experience and looking at it through a behavior lens. I suspect that in our world today, at least in the United States, that we've inadvertently undermined the development of resilience. And here's how we've done it. A couple of reasons. One is social media. The kids are stuck indoors all day, right? Doing this stuff.
For sure.
As part of that, that when we were kids, Mike, I don't know about you, man, but my mom said, being when the streetlights were on. So that meant I went out and I did all sorts of stupid things. You know what I mean? I made mistakes. I fell down. I did shit I shouldn't have done, right?
Guilty.
All sorts of things, right? But I had to, I learned from bad consequences for good consequences that tomorrow is going to be a new day, that I'm going to live, that I can overcome this stuff. And so my resilience over time was shaped. And I think that we could build this. Certainly we can build this into people, right? And where they learn, because it kind of feels like, you know, this, you know, I'm wondering, I'm getting, and I don't want to say it's a thing, but I'm just wondering about the resilience of this next generation, because we have created the bubble. And I've been one of these dads, man. Now, I wouldn't quite call myself a helicopter parent, but I don't think I let my kid fall enough. You know what I mean? So he could learn to, you know, to stand up on his own. And he's doing great, but it seems like the lessons he's learning now, I learned when I was like 8, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, Paul, you bring up a really interesting, that's an interesting discussion, I think. And it's certainly worthy of any parent to sort of ask themselves those questions. And I think it even goes to something, you know, and I think this kind of comes out of like dialectical behavior therapy, for example. They talk about teaching tolerance, like being able to experience adverse affect and adverse feelings or aversive feelings, tolerate it and learn how to cope with it so that you can then make a different decision. And kind of, they call it sort of using your wise mind, like, okay, I'm not overly ruled by my emotions right now. I'm not thinking about the past or the future too much. I'm in the moment, and I've learned that I can tolerate feeling lousy for a while and then still function. So that's a piece of resilience that I think, you know, if we're kind of unpacking a little bit, I think that tolerance training is something, and people get uncomfortable with that. I understand why. It's like, you know, as a parent, when my kids would cry, I'd be like, oh my God, what did I do? And then I'd realize, okay, the clock would tick a little bit and they'd be like, oh, they're calming down. Okay, now we can talk. And oh, wait a minute. Well, they still have a pulse. That's good. You know, they're okay. And then I kind of go, yeah, I still have a pulse. I'm okay too. So, you know, I don't know. I think that piece is just, you know, undersold. We see it in like sort of sporting contexts where people are being coached to kind of, you know, not play hurt, but like, you know, right now your muscles are burning, but you still have to be able to get down the field and do this. You have to play with some discomfort. And that's, I think, that's an undervalued skill. Not to hurt yourself or let yourself go without medical care. I mean, I'm not in any way talking about that, but you're not feeling great, but you're still doing the best you can, you know, and it's okay.
I think that people think teaching tolerance is like antithetical or contradictory to trauma-informed care.
I think so too.
Yeah. And I would argue that, man, we have to shape it. You know what I mean? We can't just throw people in there.
No,
it's got to
right.
be there just, you know, like if it was lifting weights, it'd be like, I can lift 100 pounds, right? And somebody's going to slide a half a pound on either side. And they're not even going to know that there's an additional pound on there, right? It's so small that over time, they're building up this resilience, right? We look at it as like some sort of strength, you know, to continue behaving under adversity, you know. And then over time, they have this repertoire, because this repertoire is about adapting. And this is how we've survived as organisms, right?
Right.
Adaptability is like, yeah, man, you have to. And so, you know, I think that we need to start just putting – we can't be rule governing approach. It's got to be nuanced. It's got to be individualized for each person. But we need to think about this concept of resiliency as something that, okay, we are gonna pull some back some stuff. But now, how are we gonna teach resilience? What skills they need, first of all? So we gotta make sure they have that skill, and then we gotta make sure my fighters can perform the skill great outside of the cage. I put them in the cage for the first time and I don't see any of that stuff, right? They're not resilient under those conditions that adverse. So I've got to create an environment where they're being exposed just a couple things, right? Their opponent's not throwing all sorts of things. They might be throwing one jab and they're throwing it live, but they're doing it 25%. And then they're increasing it, right? So I'm slowly exposing them to, and I'm getting them into success, in touch with success. So I think that, you know, these are important behavioral points for everybody to consider, because I think that PBIS and trauma-informed care can certainly go hand in hand. You know what I mean? I would say that if you really want a trauma-informed care or school, for example, it should be PBIS, right? I mean, these are fundamentally in the same boat.
Completely.
Yeah, because we're looking at teaching and reinforcing behaviors and creating good relationships. And let's have all those values embedded, the principles of trauma-informed care. They should be there anyhow. They need to be up the ladder. That leader can't be beating up the teacher and expect that they're going to create this environment for the student. And that district leader can't be doing it to the school leader, and the state leader can't be doing it to the district leader, you know?
Well, you know, like there's that old adage, you know, crap runs downhill, so to speak, right? And that's too much. You know, I think that's a value that does not get questioned nearly enough. This idea that like, well, you know, that's just how it is. Is it? I mean, who made, you know, okay, maybe for 10,000 years, that's how it's gone. But I didn't see anything in there about it has to be like that until the end of time, right?
We could actually think about that in another way. If we say crap runs downhill, let's say we go into the classroom and it's, you know, it's a crappy environment. Well, you're the one that crapped at the top. It ran downhill and it pulled up in the classroom, right? So you are responsible for that stuff. So, and again, we can go up the state, we can go up the federal level. There's just so many ways to look at it. But people get blamed on the front line too much, and that just drives me nuts. But thanks for going there with the trauma-informed care stuff with me and PBIS. This has been fun, man. I enjoy speaking with you. I always have.
Me too, Paul. You're awesome, dude, man. In addition to just learning a lot from talking to you, I feel like I always have some good laughs, and we always get to really think about some stuff that I'm always provoked to think about new things. So thank you for including me. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I encourage, I always tell people, actually, because we're talking about this stuff, I have a few books, Quick Wins, Quick Responses, Deliberate Coaching, all about, you know, improving behavior and performance in schools. But I also have a bunch of free articles. You know, if you're interested in this stuff, you go on my LinkedIn. I have 100-something articles through PCM. I have, I think, 38 different newsletters that are all about. So you don't have to pay a cent, you know. PCMA has we have a YouTube that's all about improving behavior. It's all rooted in this stuff.
Honestly, I watch that stuff all the time, Paul.
Man. Yeah.
Most certainly. I tune into that. And it definitely guides my work. And I'm very appreciative of it. The dissemination part is just so critical, because I kind of feel like I do my best to do that, certainly when I'm working with people individually. But I think it's really key to get those messages out there, so people are kind of coming in. They're like, oh, I kind of know a little something about this. This is, it's not exactly what I've heard. You know, this is what it really is.
And I think we got to reteach a lot of people and stuff, reframe it. I think Robert used to say it. I forget. He was citing some research or somebody who said, like, if you don't get PBS going the first year, the chance of being successful go like drastically down. I forget what he actually said.
Yeah, it was, I don't remember the specific percentages anymore, but it really was like this notion of you kind of have to do something at about 90% fidelity right at the jump, because if you do that, then other initiatives have a much higher, you know, less likely to succeed. So you kind of have to nail it that first time out and then do it really well.
This is why we should be doing quick wins. Stop trying to do, you know, the PBS should unpack just an area, just one transition in the classroom, one transition in the school, right? They can happen concurrently. Well, like, oh, this stuff works.
No, I think you're right. And I think there was a little, I would go back and say, I think there was a little bit, maybe too much rigidity about that part of things. Like, oh, it has to be this way. Why? Well, that's what they said, you know, and that
comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of it. Right. And also less lack of fluency. We talk about fidelity, but got to be fluent and not just the steps for it, right? It's got to be fluent in the principles behind it. So that way you're not rule governed, that you're making things fit contextually.
Well, yeah. And that's a big piece. Like I particularly enjoy is just talking about the why of it, because I know just as a rational, presumably a rational adult, like when someone just tells me do it because I said to do it, my immediate response is like, okay, first of all, don't tell me what to do. Second of all, explain to me why I'm doing this, right?
Yeah.
But that's just annoying. I mean, I don't think that's, you know, an atypical response. So
do we share the same values? My wife and I went to like a nice steakhouse the other night. And I went in there. It's the first time it's happened. And the woman told me to take off my hat. And like, I've never actually experienced that before. And, you know, she didn't say it very nicely, you know. I mean, I could have responded like, take off your wig. You know what I mean? I didn't, you know. And no. I just took it off and I smiled. And I just walked by and my wife said, you didn't like that. Like, you know me, I didn't like it at all. You know, she didn't do anything mad. But I don't like being told what to do. And I try to like.
It's awful, right?
Yeah, I mean, help people the why. Like, you know what I mean? Help them. And it's just so much better, you know, that way when you involve people. And that's why involving people. But a lot of times we try to involve people, but we haven't done the why well enough because not everybody can tell stories. Not everybody can help get people in touch with this vision, right? And this is where people need to put on a leading hat. They're missing that leading hat. That's this motivating operation, right? Like creating a want for the future, and it gets their behavior going. And our job is to get people in touch with reinforcement, you know? It all makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
All right, brother. Well, hey, thanks again, man, for coming on, Mike.
Anytime, buddy.
It's been great. Oh, by the way, if somebody wants to reach out to you and get in touch with you, what's the best way? I mean, you can tell them to connect with you on LinkedIn or I don't know.
Yeah, LinkedIn is a good spot. I do check it fairly often. And,
okay, I'll link your name in the show notes and so people can reach out to Mike there. And Mike, where are you at, by the way, right now? I forget what state are you in?
Well, I'm in West Virginia now. Kind of a difference from Florida for sure. But it's a beautiful place. Getting to do some different things, which I'm kind of excited about. I'm working more as a children's therapist now.
Oh,
and
cool, man.
I'm good. You know, at some point I will be licensed in the state of West Virginia as a psychologist. So now I'm kind of working with going back to my roots, working with, kids in a therapeutic setting, which I forgot how much I loved. It's really a blast. So
I'd love seeing people where they'd love to be. So, all right, Mike, good chatting with you, man.
Hey, always, buddy. Take care. Stay in touch.
Traditionally, many crisis management systems have taken a what's wrong with you approach that begins as a person escalates when addressing behavioral issues. PCM, as a trauma-informed approach rooted in applied behavior analysis, shifts this perspective from what's wrong with you to what happened to you by having a complete picture of a person's situation in life, past and present. This approach is fundamental to applied behavior analysis and therefore PCM, as it seeks to determine the root causes of behavior based on both the current environment and the individual's history as a means of individualizing education, treatment, and support. For more about PCM, check out crisisintervention.com.